U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
That music means it's Friday afternoon. Welcome to the weekend on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here, high atop the Chicago River in the WGN radio studios. Thanks very much for tuning in today. We will talk a little bit later in the program with Dennis Rodkin about real estate and the Chinese buying that was anticipated in Chicago and in the U.S. really is starting to dry up. So it's an interesting story when it comes to real estate. Also, when it comes to real estate, Sterling Bay is getting into the laboratory business. I didn't understand this, but apparently there is a shortage of commercial high-grade lab space in Chicago. So a lot of startups that begin to thrive here end up moving out. Sterling Bay is trying to make a move to increase the amount of lab space available here, and that includes the Lincoln Yards project as well. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. Andrea Haines is in the studio now from the Chicago Tribune. Andrea, how much money did you make in your last job?
I don't have to tell you.
Governor Pritzker signed a bill this week. It's now a law that makes it illegal for employers to ask about employee history when it comes to salary.
Exactly. So it's 60 days before this takes effect. But at that point, you will not, if you're an applicant for a job, they cannot ask you how much you've made in your previous jobs, which is, of course, always used as a benchmark for how much of an offer you're going to get.
Right. And so there's two ways. We'll go pre-gender and then we'll go gender. Pre-gender is if you're an employer and you're hiring someone and you're budgeted $75,000 for the job, but you find out that the person you're going to hire has only been making $38,000, you could probably get away with offering $45,000 and saving $30,000 a year, right? And so by not being able to ask that question, you go in sort of ignorant to their history.
True, which, you know, in the good sense should force you to set what that job is worth
job,
in another
and you'll be paid.
Versus tying it to that person's history, because in a way, what is it relevant what they've earned to do something else? You need to know what is it worth it to you to do what you want them to do.
And so when you throw gender into it, and historically that women are paid less than men, so women would be answering that previous pay question at a lower amount. So the job offer they would get would be for presumably less money.
Exactly. And it's those issues that make it an issue of policy, because, if you're a woman, or of course there can be other reasons, people of color, other reasons that maybe people are lowballed, then that dogs you for the rest of your life, because one salary builds on the next, builds on the next, builds on the next, and you theoretically are never going to dig out of that rut that you kind of started in.
Tom Gimbel, the CEO of LaSalle Network, will be on later in the program, and he helps with its job placement, so I can't wait to hear what he has to say about that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a spectrum of reactions, pro and con. I like it. I think it's kind of smart and challenging, and it kind of forces the conversation to a different place, which I think is interesting.
I love it because, right, this is about what the job pays or should pay, not about what the applicant coming in should be receiving. Now, there's another plan, a different one in Massachusetts, that allows employers to ask wage history, but only after making a job and salary offer.
Which then, why do they want to know?
I don't know. I read that and like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Okay, so we'll talk with the Gimbel about that a little later in the program. Another big story this week was the Capital One hacking, where millions of us, right, lost our data. Was it 100 million? Was that right? 100 million Capital One credit applications, 140,000 Social Security numbers, and 80,000 bank account numbers, all this data. It's not routine in that these things happen, but what's really extraordinary in this case was the person who did it and why she did it.
Yeah, it's funny because everyone has been talking for the last week about how much money they might get out of it, because theoretically you can get some reimbursement if you were affected by it. But this story is really interesting because it talks about the woman who actually did the hacking that led to this. And it's really, you know, the person who's been charged here, it really just paints a portrait of somebody who was really troubled.
This is a mental health story.
It's very much a mental health story.
And so she had several different jobs. One of her jobs was at Amazon, right? And Amazon with the cloud services, where she had access to this information in one way or another. She still had to hack in, but she sort of did it. But if you read this story in the Tribune by Gene Johnson and Frank Bajak, is that correct? You really read about how, I mean, I don't want to use the phrase cry for help because that's odd, but she was kind of bragging about it. She'd been in trouble with stalking people who had helped her. She'd had sort of acquaintances who would take her to in custody sort of treatment plants or facilities, and she would keep leaving. And so the woman seems to have, and she's in gender transition too, right?
Exactly. I mean, it almost has that feeling of suicide by cop, if you know that expression,
no,
where it's like somebody is just so desperate that they're basically doing something dramatic to, it sounds like, almost get help or just get taken out of the world in a world that they can't deal with.
I mean, at one point, she even kind of tweeted to that, right? Or said something in a Slack conversation, I'm going to do something where they can't help now, but lock me away.
Yeah, and one sort of alarming detail was that apparently she had discussed shooting up a place.
Right.
And so I think if you look at it that way, I'd rather have 100 million people be hacked than have, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 shot someplace.
Especially in this case, where it seems like she wasn't trying to make, she didn't monetize it, it doesn't look like.
Yeah,
but it also, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, fine. Yeah.
It also speaks to how we have to look not just at foreign governments, but employees for these companies when it comes to our privacy.
Completely agree. It's like a disturbed individual, if it's in fact this person, it sounds like, and it definitely points to vulnerabilities where one person like this can create this much havoc.
It's a fascinating story. Check it out at chicagotribune.com. I think you'll be surprised by what you read. Andrea, thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
It's 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Tom Gimbel is in the studio, the CEO of LaSalle Network. Tom, welcome back to
the
Business Lunch.
Always good to see you, Steve.
I promise you won't damage the equipment while you're here.
Nothing that you'll catch me for.
Okay, so the jobs report came out today.
Great jobs report.
The number of jobs created was a little like 1,000 less than expected.
Yeah, it was 164 or something like that.
The unemployment rate stayed at 3.7. They thought it might go to 3.6.
Yep.
But it's the wages that we're talking about, right?
Correct.
All right, tell me why it's a good news number.
When wages creep up a little bit, and it, you know, people want to see huge percentages and huge dollars. It's not like that. You're taking hundreds of thousands, millions of workers that they accumulate data from a myriad of different industries, from construction to retail to white collar, and they blend it all together to get. I mean, that's the problem with the BLS, is from a geographic standpoint and what it's doing. So any inch up is good. And when you start creeping up, a tenth of a percentage point, two-tenths of a percentage point, it's real data.
So average wages up 3.2% year over year.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been talking about, right, with this economic recovery, the thing that's been slow.
I mean, if you remember back in the days, you know, a COLA, cost of living adjustment, was always, if you get a 3% raise every year, you know, back before the internet, right?
It was
3% was standard in big business. And now if we're getting 3% year over year, that's a good amount for a healthy economy.
But we should be growing more?
That's the argument to be made by people who want change or think that things aren't great. I say this to you every time we talk more economically focused, is we would have killed for this 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable.
A total labor force sets a record at 163.4 million. Why is that significant?
Well, when you have, because the question that where people who are naysayers want to go is that there are people not participating
in the labor
force.
They've given up. Right.
They've given up. And it used to be that 2.5% in an idyllic world, going back 20, 30 years ago, people would say 2.5% of the population is unemployable. You're just never going to have it. And I think that number is probably a little bit closer to 3, maybe a little over 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're in this situation. So the naysayers will come out and say, oh, the real unemployment rate is really 8.5%.
Which is the way it was. There was a time when it was that way,
a
right?
A long time ago. But the difference is, okay, let's say that's a true statement.
No, but even in the early days of the economic recovery, and the unemployment rate was coming down,
yes,
there still were a lot of people who had just sort of given up.
Always.
Right.
There's always.
And so now over time, we've seen fewer and fewer of those people giving up.
Correct. More and more people are coming into the workforce. And you can, to point and say, oh, there aren't jobs for everybody.
Right.
Okay.
One other number then. I don't have it in front of me, but the work week shrank.
Right. The average hours worked in the week.
And tell me why that's significant.
I think it's significant because it's an employee's market right now, because the unemployment rate's so high that employees don't have to work as many hours as they were usually.
All right, then I'm going to cut the show short here today. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Don't tell my staff.
We were talking to Andrea Haines earlier about Governor Pritzker signing that new law where you don't have to, you are now forbidden, the bosses, from asking a potential employee, you're already grimacing, about their salary history. I think that's, I love it, but you know
you
more about
love,
it.
You don't love it.
I think I do love it, but you tell me why you don't love it.
So you love it if you're hot, if you think people should be paid the same.
Right.
Is that what you think?
No, that you know what? For me, it has less to do with gender equity. I'm all for
it
that.
It has nothing to do with gender equity.
No, but my why I like it is because if you are hiring me for a job that you think is worth $75,000, I don't think you should know that I would maybe take it for $38,000, right? I mean, you should offer me $75,000.
The difference is that people don't really talk about is that when I hire you for $75,000, my expectations of you go up. You're going to get fired faster.
Well, that's okay, though, because if you've created...
No. It's okay before you get the job, and it's okay once you get the job. When you're fired, you don't think it's okay. You say, I'll take it for less money.
But if I was making $68,000 taking that job, the expectations are still the same.
No, they're not. There's 10% less.
No. So you're offering me a $75,000 job, okay? Yeah. If I made $68,000 coming in, so it's a $7,000 pay hike, the expectations are just as high on me as if it was a $40,000 pay hike for me, right? I mean, so
yes,
I don't think
but it's $68,000 of what you were making. You're probably, depending on the company and the experience, it's all different, right? It's a unique experiences, but you're closer to being ready for that job. If you were making $38,000, you were either so grossly underpaid, which is very, very rare.
But can't you tell if I'm ready for that job by my work history, by my resume, by my references, not by how much I was being paid?
I've been waiting to sue people who apply for jobs and say they can do a job based on experience, and they can't do it for being a liar.
All seriously,
no, you can't tell.
So you think, or you're saying, not that you think, you're saying that salary history is an implication of ability.
Yes. Okay. Now, I'm not on the reverse side. I'm not saying that people who make a certain level haven't been paid too much.
Right.
Right. It goes both ways. But yes, if somebody's making $50,000 and they have certain levels of experience, maybe they're not worth $100,000. You're also in the expectation management business. Let me ask you a question. If Jason Hayward were making $10 million this year instead of $22 million, would you be happier?
I don't know how to answer that question.
It's the expectation management. You fire somebody who's a C performer for $100,000. If they were a C performer for $50,000, you'd have kept them.
I still don't know how that applies, though, because if you have a job that's a $100,000 job...
You might tweak and this is also what's forgotten, you might tweak the roles of the job based on the salary. So if I know that you were making $40,000, I might say, instead of 75, I'm going to pay you 50, but I'm going to have you do less.
So you're not going to hire the job?
I might not hire you, but I would have hired you before.
Okay, well, I can see that we're going to disagree on this.
Well, you disagree on a lot, but I like you.
I also admit that you also know a lot more than I do about this. So
it's all relative. And that's the beautiful thing is there's an employer for everybody, and there's a butt for every saddle. You just got to find them.
Speaking of butts and saddles, you just came from the Olympics. What's this?
Well, we had the L'Olympics for LaSalle Olympics, and we just took the afternoon off from 12 o'clock until 5 and rented out Bussy Woods out in the Schaumburg Elk Grove Village area, and we had inflatable jousting, and we had dunking for apples and three-legged races.
Okay, so I always ask you this because we got to run, but the percentage of your employees who really like doing that?
Oh, I think not everybody participated. Some just sat in the sun and had a beer.
Okay.
But I would say it's probably 85 to 90% really were happy.
All right, Tom Gimbel from the LaSalle Network, thanks for coming by.
Always good to be with you.
Yeah, it is always good to be. We disagree.
Yeah. And it's just an opinion. It's not fact.
No, but yours is more informed. That bothers me because I like to think I'm right.
That's why you're on the radio. My mind's informed.
It's the Trust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so we've talked about this a lot, about these condo buildings and this pressure for them to move toward apartments, right? So developers start buying up the condos within, and then they can flip the whole building. You could really want to keep your condo, but by law, if 75% of your fellow owners want to sell the whole building, they can sell the whole building.
They can sell the whole building, yeah. So Illinois condo law requires that 75% of ownership vote in favor of a bulk sale. If it's lower than that, obviously the sale can happen. And we've seen a few examples. We talked multiple times about River City in the South Loop. They had to vote three times to get to that 75%. This is written into state condo law. And the new wrinkle, because we've had so many of these deconversion votes,
right,
and people get upset, the minority voter, the voter who doesn't want to sell, is forced to sell if 75% say so. So now two aldermen have introduced an ordinance in Chicago where in Chicago we'd have an override on top of the state law where it wouldn't be 75%, it would be 85%. You'd have to have 85% vote in favor of a bulk sale in order to go through. So obviously a smaller minority gets inconvenienced, but there is still a minority forced to sell.
And I would imagine this would be a pretty easy pass for the city council?
It's hard to say because it's, first of all, there's this whole question of home rule. Chicago does have home rule. We're the biggest city in the state, and we often have rules that supersede what the state has. But the question is going to be, is there enough support for this kind of thing on the city council, because they may think, you know, if 75% of the building right. wants to sell, you should go ahead. So we're going to see. Nothing will happen until the September city council
meeting. It's funny, I happened to be walking by Francis Parker School this week.
Right.
And then I read, I think it was Ryan Ory's story in the Tribune about how that is a very wealthy school. I think
right.
it's 40 grand to go there or something like that. They're kind of landlocked, so they're trying to buy up the condo buildings around them.
Yeah, you know, so this ordinance was introduced before Ryan Ory's story came out. Ryan, I'm jealous that he found the story because it's a really
right,
good
story.
Story
yeah.
But it illustrates what's going on here. People have voted against selling to Francis Parker. According to Ryan's story, the owners have voted against selling to Francis Parker. Francis Parker appears to be trying something that developers have done, which is you buy space in the building and then you have votes on the board. And if enough time went by, perhaps Francis Parker would have bought the majority of the units. But you would imagine that would take years,
long,
10,
long time,
15,
right,
20
right.
years. But this would be the sort of thing that such an ordinance might protect against, because once again, you have to get an even larger majority, 85% of votes instead of 75%, in order to sell. So it's almost as if the two are happening for the same reason, but we don't know that they are happening for the same reason.
Okay, so that's one thing that we've talked about before. We'll revisit. Another one is, I want to say this was in Buffalo Grove, that there was a Chinese real estate office that opened up in Buffalo Grove,
yeah.
of all places, because the market was so hot for Chinese nationals buying property in the U.S. And now I read your writing this week about the fact that that pipeline has sort of dried up.
Has dried up, yeah. So they opened this Chinese agency is called 5i5J, which in Chinese characters means I love my home.
I know.
And oh, sorry, I forgot. Should we do the rest of the broadcast in Chinese?
In Chinese? You know what? We'll do that on the podcast.
Oh,
tune
okay.
in for that.
Okay. So they ended up in Buffalo Grove because their theory was Chinese buyers are especially interested in schools. Best high school in the state,
Stevenson
is right there. So they set up there. This was a couple of years ago when Chinese investment in U.S. homes was building fast. Over the course of 4 years, moved from about $20 billion in purchases to over $30 billion in purchases nationwide. Chicago never had a really big slice of that, but we had a piece of it. And so there were a few things that were sort of aiming toward the Chinese buyer. One would be that agency. The other would be Vista Tower,
which
right
we could
here.
Hit, we could hit with a rock from yeah, yours.
Probably not a good idea, but yeah, right
finished.
Here on our block. And they were looking at selling to Chinese buyers. They had a Chinese partner, Wanda, which is a major real estate company in China. And the idea was some of our buyers will be people who are moving capital out of China into the United States. What has happened, they told me, is that while they wouldn't say they had a target figure for how many Chinese buyers they would have, they're disappointed in the total they have, which is 12. 12 out of about 400 condos in the building.
And so, we always overreact or react saying, well, this is about the trade war. It's,
right.
It's maybe a little about the trade war, but they're also, the Chinese government is putting limits on capital draining out of the country.
Yeah. So the first step was the Chinese government trying to slow down their, well, again, money was flowing out of China into U.S. homes and into many other forms of real estate as well.
Which isn't good if you're running the Chinese government or Communist Party.
Exactly, right. And so, and you see these places like this real estate agency in Buffalo Grove and this condo tower downtown, multiply those by all the cities all over the country and the United States and the world where people are doing this, and China started cracking down on how much money you could take out of the country. So that begins the slowdown in Chinese buying. And then what I heard from agents is agents who deal with Chinese buyers, and these are inbound, this is inbound Chinese money, not Chinese live in Chicago. What I heard is the trade war then really put a clamp down the lid that was already going down. So Chinese investment in U.S. real estate dropped by 35% in the year ended April 2019 from the prior 12-month period, and may drop even further in the year that will end April 2020.
And so is Vista in trouble, or they're just going to have to work a little harder to fill their building?
Well, what they've done is they had a marketing partner in China who had sort of a traveling sales center, that sort of thing. What they told me is we're just not looking at China. Right. We're not trying to get Chinese buyers. Are they in trouble? They're still making sales. They just maybe it's not the easy...
I'm just wondering now if I should go over there. Maybe it's they finally reached my price level.
I
just say not yet.
Not yet, Steve.
You know, so we also talk a lot, and there was a standard number of things. It's always good to see you, Dennis.
Thanks, Steve. I don't know what your price level is, but I'm guessing
it's not there.
It's not in the multimillion-dollar level yet.
Home price growth in Chicago is suffered, right? 3.5-year low.
Yeah.
Most recently. So we know about that. We've talked about that. But you also have a story about how that's impacting new home sales.
Yeah.
Because, well, tell me why.
Well, so home prices aren't growing as fast as they were. We're according to the Case-Shiller Index, in May, home prices in Chicago grew, in the Chicago area, grew by about 1.6%. That's about half what they were doing a year earlier when they were over 3% for a very long time. Similar drop off nationwide, but we're way down at that little margin. And one of the results of all this is very closely connected to our drying up home building industry, our suburban primarily home building industry. At the same time, I got data for the first half of the year from Tracy Cross Associates, which is a home building consultancy out in Schaumburg. And they pointed out that really over the course of about 10 years, it's been a little up, a little down, but it's really just been flat. And the primary reason, well, a primary reason is that generally new homes sell at prices that are competitive to lower than existing homes.
Dennis Rodkin, read more about that at chicagobusiness.com and Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. The ag world is keeping their eyes open about the meat substitute options that are so prevalent these days. You might have heard of Beyond Meat or the Impossible Burger. Burger King will begin to roll out the Impossible Whopper, a lab-grown burger, to all of their locations next week. And given the popularity of these, it could get some serious traction. But with locations just about everywhere, this could shake the industry for sure. And speaking of food, Mars is starting a food startup incubator, and they've got six fresh companies ready to make something new. Promise, Brooklyn Deli, Fora, Noble Burger, Oxtail, and True Made Foods are the six that are under the wing of the food and candy maker. They each get 4 months and $50,000 to gain some momentum for their business. But it's not all easy. I bet it's like Survivor, food startup version.
Six food startups will enter the incubator. 4 months, $50,000, one winner. Who will reign supreme?
I'd watch that TV show. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:53, the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Danny Ecker joins us from the Crane's Chicago Business Newsroom, and we're going to, I've got a Petri dish in my hand here, Danny, and I don't know what to do with it.
Well, you could do all kinds of experiments there, but, you know, does that qualify as lab space, the studio?
No, I guess so. Maybe I did not realize that this was an entity, I guess, until I read your article. It certainly makes sense. But Chicago has a shortage, or at least we're stocked up, we're filled up when it comes to commercial lab space in the city. And so Sterling Bay, the big real estate developer, has hired someone on to sort of develop more and to sell it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think shortage is a fair way to characterize it there. I mean, this has been a problem that has been identified in recent years by a lot of the people at the, you know, local universities who focus on life sciences startups. These are people that do, you know, biomedical and pharmaceutical research. And there are these companies that create drugs and other technologies that come out of them. And, you know, there's kind of been this bad trend for Chicago, where some of the technologies and innovations that are born here, when it's time to grow and they become a company, they leave and they go to places like Boston and North Carolina and San Francisco and San Diego, where there are these communities of life sciences companies, and more importantly, the sort of sufficient lab space, high quality lab space they need to kind of test their products and grow. And so it's sort of this, you know, missed opportunity that a lot of developers are saying, well, why don't we have that?
So in a way, we've talked about this when it comes to universities in Illinois and in Chicago, where they educate STEM students. Those STEM students, by and large, had been leaving the area because they had the jobs there. I think that's been reversed in recent years. And so we mm-hmm. have this here where if we build it, when it comes to lab space, they will stay.
Right. And that's kind of the idea that Sterling Bay has here. And they obviously have been one of the most prolific developers in the city in recent years with their work in Fulton Market. And most of their work's been in the office market. And now that they've got the approval from the city to develop Lincoln Yards, this massive campus along the north branch of the Chicago River, you know, they're looking at trying to really dive in and make a push into life sciences and say, well, why don't we do it? You know, why can't we build this community? We have the space. We have all these companies. They see an opportunity here. So the news this week was they just hired one of the few biomedical industry veterans who has been a champion of leasing. Her name's Kathy Vorwald. She headed up one of the only, I guess, call it the only nodes in the city that really has some high quality lab space. That's actually at IIT.
Uh-huh.
They've got the University Tech Park. They're filled up there. They got 18 companies there. She said she had to turn away business in recent years of companies that want that space. Sterling Bay just brought her on and saying, lead us there and help us cultivate some of these companies and we'll help build and develop space for them.
And so the idea is that I know they've got a spot already on North Halsted, but Lincoln Yards will eventually have a biotech component to it?
That's what Andy Glore, you know, the managing partner for Sterling Bay, that's what has said. I mean, they have to kind of still sell this vision for Lincoln Yards to companies to say, oh yeah, this is a place you want to be, and you can grow here, and it's going to be this great live, work, play environment. That's kind of the vision. I think he foresees life sciences having a fairly decent part of that, but just based on the scale that you can do there and the fact that that's kind of what you need to be able to kind of get some of these companies to be able to see their future here.
All right, I'll put this Petri dish away and wait to see what comes up on the New North side. Danny Ecker, writing about it at Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for stopping by today.
Sure thing.